All financial advice provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor. I'm speaking to you from the borough of Queens in New York City. It is the 8th day of March, 2023. My guests today are Michael Oliver, Dr. Quentin Henning, and Jimmy Rogers. I've titled today's show, Jim Rogers' World 20 Years Later. Well, that's because 20 years ago or so, Jim Rogers wrote a book about his travels around the world. He visited some 116 countries. No, he didn't go to visit the high and the mighty. He went to visit the common folks, the people that were, the people like you and I, people that are just doing common things and making society work or not work so well. And he sort of found that you could find truth in some of the most unusual places when you visit these other countries. Anyway, Jimmy will be with me in the third segment of today's show. Quentin Henning will be joining me in just a couple of minutes. From now to talk about Goliath Resources. That's a company that is really developing a multi-million ounce gold and silver deposit in British Columbia that I think the market has largely ignored so far. And so we'll look forward to what Quentin Henning has to say in the second segment. But right now, I'm happy to tell you that Michael Oliver is with me. And of course, we always like to remind you, it's olivermsa.com, olivermsa.com. To really take advantage of Michael's work. He throws a few nuggets out to you here on this show, but if you really want to take advantage of what Michael has to say, well, not so much in terms of, not necessarily intellectually, but to make money. What I'm trying to say is, yes, it's interesting what Michael has to say, but I found him to be very helpful in picking the right kind of investments to be in. So Michael, thank you so much for joining me again.
Good to be here, Jay.
Okay, so in your 360 weekend report, you wrote, "Beware of renewed commodity upturn." So I thought that this recession that we're supposed to be coming is going to drive commodities down, inflation is going to go down, we're not going to have any more problems, but you're suggesting we're going to see a renewed upturn in commodities.
That's right. The commodities are, by the way, separate them from gold.
Yes.
They sometimes move with gold. They're in sync. Sometimes they're not. So while gold was moving from its late 2015 low to its 2020 high during that same five-year period, the Bloomberg Commodity Index was capped off in a basing type action, but lower highs, lower lows. It was under pressure, in other words. And you put a lot of commodities down to levels that you would call theoretical zero. I mean, you know, commodities won't go to zero, but they're so low, they just were out of air. Okay.
Sure.
But they stayed that way for like 5 years in this space. October of 2020, we put out a report said there's a commodity explosion coming. At that point, Bloomberg Index was just above 70. By early 2022, meaning at the time of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, they had doubled,
right?
Went up to 140 on the Bloomberg. Okay. And about several weeks after that war began, commodities peaked and went down and entered what I call, what I would define as a corrective mode. And they've been in that corrective mode for now over a year.
Mm-hmm.
Despite that war having occurred, which occurred basically when you should have sold commodities, interestingly, and oil, for example. And they stayed depressed and drifted lower, only back down in the lower 100s, though, not back down to 70. Okay. So it's what we call an intermediate correction. It's now pretty old. It's like a year old.
Yeah.
We see technical reasons for the Bloomberg, which is trading 106, 107 right now. If it trades up to about 109 area, it's going to break out of our metrics and indicate, okay, my correction's over, I'm going back up again. Okay. And there's some other longer term triggers up there that if it does get another surge, it could trigger these bigger things that could really get you into a whole nother up wave in commodities, which we think will occur. Okay. Now, the Fed, no doubt, when they look at the Bloomberg, they go, oh boy, look what we've done. You know, well, you didn't do that. It was already in corrective mode at the point when that war started. So don't blame the war on it, you know, all that.
Yeah.
But when you look at the major asset categories right now, you got the bonds, which have had the hell beat out of them, especially long-term treasuries.
Sure.
Yields have gone up a lot. And frankly, when we do our studies of annual momentum of T-bonds, if the stock market had replicated what T-bonds did between late 2020, when we got bearish on bonds, and October of last year, the S&P would be back down to 2015 price levels, meaning under 2000.
Wow.
Okay. It would have wiped out the entire bull market. That's what bonds did. So when you look at T-bonds price-wise or on our annual momentum, it looks like, you know, that might be it. That might have been the bear low or something around there. So it wouldn't shock us that the current decline in bonds, the current upticks in yields again, might nip out that low.
Mm-hmm.
Not by much. I think we're basically bottoming the bond market. Now, how could that be? I'm talking long end, especially.
Right.
If we get a commodity resurgence, because what's that going to cause the Fed to do? It's going to give them justification to continue tightening.
Right.
Well, how can bonds go up if the Fed, you know, it confuses you, right? Okay. Right. Now, the other big piece of the puzzle, the three puzzle pieces here I'm looking at, is gold. And it's getting whacked today. You know, it's down 1% or so within last week's range. But it's, look at the price. It's in the 1830s, okay? Mm-hmm. If you go to the left, the close 2022 at 1830-something. You closed 2021, you closed at 1830-something.
Right.
And you could draw a line through about the 1800 level, and it goes right through the middle of the range that we've had since mid-2020 through the present. You've been below it a couple hundred, above it a couple hundred, but that's where you are. Mm-hmm. How come gold isn't falling apart? If the central banks are engaged in the biggest tightening they've ever done in decades, you know,
right?
How come it's not falling apart? What does it suspect or know? And I suspect it's that third piece of the puzzle. Mm-hmm. It's the stock markets of the world. We don't just look at the U.S. I just did a report issued yesterday on China, India, and Japan as well. They're in better shape on price charts than we are. In other words, it looks like, hey, they look pretty good. Maybe we'll go with them. Oh, you know. But when I do an annual momentum study, they look very vulnerable to join in to the downside. It wouldn't take a flicker to get them going. Okay.
Wow.
I think we're headed for a worldwide stock recession depression,
mm-hmm.
which will have real world in the street type consequences. The kind of thing that you're not getting the data points right now, you know, unemployment and so forth, but you're going to get them. Credit issues, mm-hmm. credit default issues, you know, consumer debt issues. We know it's off the page. What if it implodes? You know, that's why we watch very closely the bank sector, for example.
Yeah.
Most people are looking at tech or they're looking at this or that, and they're not looking at the banks. We're watching the banks week by week and the financial sector. We think that probably that third piece of the puzzle is the one to watch because it's the one that's going to surprise people. Because if rates don't go up anymore because of market forces that like, you know, high interest rates and therefore buying T-bonds,
right.
And bonds stop going down and therefore rates stop going up, why would the stock market go down? That should be good for stocks, right?
Well, you would think so.
Ah, but what if stocks say, hey, we're going into a worldwide recession?
Right, right.
And then what does that cause the central banks to do?
Right. Print.
Okay. Well, that's what they're here for. Yeah. That's why they were created, right. Is to support government debt markets, pay for government when government can't bring in revenue through taxes, which that doesn't pay for government processes anyway. We know that.
No.
They do it through printing. And which market knows that? The Sherlock Holmes market out there knows the answer, the gold market.
The gold market.
Right. I think that's why gold has been picking its teeth sideways now for 3 years, up, down, up, down, up, down, not crashing like everybody thinks it should. I think it knows what's coming.
Yeah.
And therefore, that's why we're watching the stock market closely, because I think not far below where you are right now, we've got some trigger numbers that indicate that this attempt to base the stock market, It's been underway actually since the lows in June of last year.
Right.
Where you've had this type of action, you know, futile buying that comes back down and goes back up, and you're hanging in there. I think that hanging in there will cease if you drop several percent below where we are right now. We've got some triggers, in which case the stock market resumes its major trend.
Right.
And that's when you start to get data points. Anyway, that's what we think.
Well, and you know, I mean, the point is that in your newsletter, of course, you provide precise numbers. As time goes on, those numbers change, and people need to be kept aware of that. And that's what the value that you provide. You provide sort of a general view of the market. So when you come on with us, I'm really thankful for you coming on. I guess, where does silver stand then? I guess you're going to have to really see gold reassert itself as a bull market. Then silver is going to overtake gold probably on the upside, right?
We think silver's already shifted to a positive mode versus gold. We think that happened at the close of September of last year. And since then, yeah, silver's having a harder sell-off right now from the highs we made a month or so ago than gold is.
Right.
But when you look at a spread chart of silver versus gold, we had a surge up in silver relative to gold from September through early this year.
Right.
Now you're having a pullback, but that pullback in silver's performance relative to gold is now within the context of an upward zigzag process, not a downward zigzag. So we still think that silver, yeah, it's a wild child. And when gold sneezes, it coughs, you know, and so forth. But when it goes up, then it beats gold.
Right.
And we think that's the wild horse to be on is the silver market and the miners. We think that there's periods of time throughout history, go back 50 years and look at it, where miners vastly underperform gold.
Right.
But then there's periods in there during certain gold trends where the miners will suddenly do 2-3 times better than gold.
Right.
And I think we're on the cusp of that.
Right. Well, those certainly would be exciting times for the Sherlock Holmes investors, I guess you call them. And we can watch we get bored when gold is picking its teeth, as you say, Michael.
Well, it's scary, you know, but compare it to other major assets.
Yeah.
And you know, if you'd owned gold for the last 3 years in the middle of its range, you're bored to death, in effect, okay? But if you're a portfolio manager, so you break even. Look at your peers, okay?
Yeah,
down 20% in the S&P last year, down 30 in NASDAQ, T-bonds down 40%. Yeah.
Michael, I recently saw some statistics that said that the FANGs, like, you know, the big tech stocks, had lost, I think, their free cash flow had come down some 80%, but the shares were only down 35%. The banks, which are three major gold mining companies, their cash flows, free cash flow has gone up dramatically. Well, from a low level, albeit 5 years ago, to a level now. But the shares have pretty much reflected the growth in cash flow. They're up some, you know, they're off their lows, but they haven't really broken out to any extent. So I guess you're probably pretty bearish still on the FANGs, on the tech stocks.
Yeah, I think the next leg down in the stock market, though, the first leg, the NASDAQ 100 was the leader.
Right.
It also led the bull market. It was a 16-fold bull market where the S&P only went up 7-fold. Okay, so it was a leader. Now, on the way down last year, it was down over 30%, S&P down 20. Okay, so it beat the S&P again, this time on the downside.
Right.
We suspect that the next leg down in stocks will see a lessening in that, and where we'll see other sectors of the stock market suffer more than they did last year relative to NASDAQ. So yeah, NASDAQ may still be weaker, but not sharply so. So the FANGs, while they'll continue down, I think other sectors that people think they're more comfortable in will start to hurt. And that'll surprise investors who feel comfy being, relatively speaking, in certain non-FANG sectors.
Right.
And I do agree with the bank argument that at some point, now, a lot of this is emotional, you got to realize.
Sure.
It's not always logical. Okay. Yeah. But when large asset managers see something happening and they see it happen long enough, they see a divorce between this category and that, and therefore it's better to be in that one than that one. Even if I don't like that one, I still got to be in it because I got to protect myself. I think that's when you're going to get a rush into the mining stocks.
Right.
When the big asset managers recognize there's a new leg down in the stock market, but that the gold and silver miners have already had their downturn.
Right.
And they don't go down. They start to follow gold up. That's when I think you suddenly see a shift. And, you know, it doesn't take much money to move that sector.
Oh, no, it's tiny. Even the gold sector and silver even more so, which I guess is why it's so volatile. But always seems to outperform gold when we're in a bull market. So it's Michael, thank you so much again for spending time with us. Your insights are always so greatly appreciated. And it's olivermsa.com, folks, to go to sign up for Michael's wonderful letter. He puts out a couple of things every weekend, but through the week when there's important markets that people need to be updated on, he does a great job of keeping his subscribers up to date. Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jay.
All right, folks, what we do, we're going to go to Quentin Henning. So don't go away. He's going to talk about Goliath Resources. Goliath is a company that's really developing a major deposit. So stick around, and Quentin will be with us in just a moment. Okay, we're back now with Dr. Quentin Henning. He is a technical advisor to Goliath Resources. That's the sponsor for today's show. Goliath Resources is developing a multi-million ounce gold equivalent deposit in the British Columbia, the Golden Triangle of British Columbia. It's a company I've been following for a number of years, since about 2020 or so, when the company made the discovery. Before I say hello to Quentin, I should tell you that the stock trades in Canada to symbol GOT. You can buy it down here in the States as I have under GOTRF. 78.4 million shares, recently trading at about 54 cents. That gives it a market cap of about $42 million. And I think it's interesting to note that this stock is pretty tightly held, actually. I Crescat Management owns Crescat Capital, I should say, owns 19.9%. Sprott owns a chunk, I think, I'm not sure exactly how much, about 9% perhaps. And management owns a chunk of stock too, so around 10%. So, you know, it's pretty well held, pretty well owned. I always like to see good, strong hands in a company that I invest in, knowing that, you know, there's big boys behind me to help reduce the risks, the financial risks. So with that said, welcome, Quentin. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much. A pleasure to be here.
Now, I believe that the discovery was made, the Gold Digger property, the gold silver discovery was made, I believe, in 2020, but maybe the first drill holes were put down in 2021. And boy, it's been a very successful exploration effort so far. Could you talk a little bit about what the company's achieved to date, maybe a little bit about the grades and the sort of scale of a mineralization that's been laid out so far?
Yeah, sure thing. Look, this is in the southern part of the Golden Triangle. So it's, you know, it's a little ways north from Kitsault, British Columbia, which is a town on one of the inlets up in that region. And it's really in the same vicinity as many, many well-known deposits, like Dolly Varden is up there. People remember the Homestake Ridge deposit. Dolly Varden now owns that. Ascot is to the north, you know, the old Premier mine and so forth. So we're in a well-positioned area in terms of, you know, deposits with big endowments like this. Okay, now the discovery was actually made, I believe, in 2019 when the receding ice, you know, from the glacial fields there, started to melt back and basically uncovered this area that has never been seen by human eyes. They sampled some quartz vein material with sulfides sticking out of the ground, and were able to you know, see some very high values of the gold and silver. All right, now in 2020 they came back in and they did some technical work in terms of doing saw channel samples. Okay, they went up and they recognize that this structure, this Sherbet zone, which is, it's really interesting because it dips at about 40, 45 degrees, and it basically goes up and it wraps around the mountain. Okay, so, you know, it's almost like the deposit is up, like if you're in the valley floor, you're looking up at the deposit. All right, they recognize that this thing wrapped around the mountain like a giant horseshoe. And so they went in and they did saw channel samples along strike on this vein, and they got some very good numbers, you know, usually a few meters up to even a few tens of meters. of good gold, say 5 to 10 gram gold, along with high silver, often in the 100 plus gram range for silver. All right, now that's kind of what whetted our appetite back in 2020 when I saw that data come through, and just the absolute simple geometry of the Sherbet zone. You know, planar zone where there's basically outcrop up and around for over a kilometer along strike. It's not hard to figure out, okay, this looks like it could have some ounces in it. Mm-hmm. All right, so we jumped in late 2020, I'm pretty sure, or maybe it was early 2021. Mm-hmm. That funded the company to do a first round of drilling. They basically went up on top of the mountain and poked holes at this dipping zone. Okay, so the geometry lends itself to, you know, fairly simple drill approach here. And they hit, you know, I think they drilled 20 odd holes, 24, I think, or something like that. And they hit the Sherbet zone in every single hole. All right. Now that was a very, very good start, particularly given that one of the holes they drilled was way down dip. You know, it showed that, mm-hmm. you know, it wasn't just a small vein up at the top of the mountain, that there was some, you know, some down dip extent to this thing. And it continued for, I believe, up to 1.3 kilometers down dip.
Yeah.
Right. So that's where they left things in 2021. They had about 24 drill intercepts. In aggregate, the width of the Sherbet was averaging, you know, around 6 meters. And the gold equivalent grade was on the order of 6.3 or 4 grams per ton. Mm-hmm. A very, very good outcome. Now, they came back in 2022 with a more aggressive approach, and they were able to drill, again, from the top down for the most part in the Sherbet area, and hit again on most of the drill holes that have been drilled to date. They're seeing the Sherbet zone very predictable, very continuous. Now, what's interesting is the thickness and the grade of the overall grade of these drill intercepts is just about exactly where it was in 2021. So it's mm-hmm. it's proving to be you know, a fairly predictable zone. Now, it's not to say it's uniformly mineralized. Sure. You know, it's definitely there structurally. It's present in these drill holes, and you know, there are places where it's high grade. They're starting to see some high grade shoots evolve. And in places where it's lower grade, but overall you can get a clear sense of what they might have. Now, they drilled a few other holes, we'll call it more exploration geared holes, along other structures that they identified, mm-hmm. particularly this northeast trending more vertical structure that kind of adjoins the Sherbet structure. It might even be a feeder for it. And they had some very high grade values, gold grade values in that structure as well. Okay, they mm-hmm. only have a couple points across that, but man, that looks good. Like that one looks like a winner. All right, so you know, what are we looking at? Well, when you start to do some simple math, back of the envelope math, you know, you probably got 1.x, maybe 1.3, 4 or 5 square kilometers of area footprint on the Sherbet zone, and the average width, call it 5-6 meters, and at average grade of maybe 6.3 or 4 gram gold equivalent. Mm-hmm. You know, you can start to come up with big numbers, and you know, people can do that math, but I've projected this thing should deliver somewhere between, say, a 3 and a 6 million ounce gold equivalent discovery.
Right, gold equivalent. And could you give our viewers some sense of the relative value between gold and silver at current prices, perhaps?
Yeah, sure. The roughly. Ratio that I think most people have been using lately, just because the trend for this silver gold ratio has been, you know, the upper 70, 78, 80. That's about the range that we're using for converting. So, you know, to break down the gold equivalent number, it's about 4.5-ish, mm-hmm. maybe up to 5 grams gold. And then a lot of the value, say a gram, gram and a half, is in silver.
Mm-hmm.
And then the balance of it is actually in the base metal component, which, you know, it sounds trivial, but it's about 1.5% or 2% of zinc and lead. Hmm. And why that's important is because of the metallurgy. And, you know, that's a whole different story. But, the metallurgy of this thing is unbelievable. Okay. The metallurgical test work that was done last year as a preliminary test showed very good gravity recovery, but it also showed a very high recovery of the balance of precious metals, you know, gold and silver, into concentrates that also focus, you know, concentrating the lead and the zinc and such. Okay, so basically, you know, you can achieve 90%+ recovery of the precious metal into these wonderful high grade concentrates that also have either lead or zinc or both, like a bull concentrate. Why is that important? Well, it means you might not need to use cyanide at all for this deposit. It also means you probably don't need to grind it all that finely, because the mineralogy is very coarse grained, and quite frankly, the sulfide minerals that you're trying to float in the gold even are coarse enough. You can liberate them at a fairly coarse size. So, I mean, like, this is a dream metallurgically. It looks like it's going to be a real winner.
Wow. That's really great. Does the company have any plans to do any sort of a maiden resource anytime, or are they going to drill another season or so? And
I think they'll drill another season. Part of the reason for that is that when they were drilling in 2022 in particular, they started to see other structures pop up, and you know, these are sub-parallel structures. So you got the Sherman zone, but you have, you know, other structures above and even maybe below. And then they have this new high grade zone that trends, it's more vertical and it trends to the northeast, adjacent to Sherbet. So I think they want to start drilling some of these other areas to see how that all plays out. But, you know, I do think they're on a good track to getting resource level data. There's no question.
Yeah, Quentin, you do a great job with your hands. You know, you sort of show those layered levels and so forth. I would just suggest to our viewers that they might want to go to Crescat Capital. Their weekly, they have a weekly video that's available on YouTube. It's excellent in terms of the market issues that are discussed. And then Quentin usually comes on and talks about the geological aspects, the economics of different projects and so forth. But there, in addition to his hand movements, he's also got some wonderful 3D models. He flips around and you can kind of really get a visual sense of in the third dimension of how these things hang together. It's very, very helpful. So if you're really interested in understanding why you're putting your money into certain companies and certain projects, Quentin can help you an awful lot. He's helpful here. All I'm saying is I'm putting in a plug for Crescat Capital. They're Friday. Every Friday, I guess it's supposed to start around 2 o'clock. Usually they're busy, might be 2:30. There's usually a ton of people waiting to get on and watch it. But I, you know, I'm not trying to talk people away from this show to go to Crescat, but I will say that if you're really serious about understanding the geology and the economics of these projects that you might want to invest in, it would be helpful. You don't have to, but it's if you care about why you're putting your money somewhere, you might want to do that. Well, Quentin, I'm just wondering also, so we're probably going to have to wait another year or two for a maiden resource, but we can kind of get a sense based on what you're saying here, what might be in store. But I would like to ask you, because in one of your recent Crescat videos, you talked about Thomas Monnicki, who is the Colorado School of Mines. That's your alma mater. He's a scientist that I know you know him very well. And he did some work on this project. And I think he's sort of in understanding the geology. Could you talk to our viewers and explain why that might be very important?
Yeah, certainly. Look, Thomas has a student working on this. So he and his student have done quite a bit of work over the past few months to better define how this deposit formed. And why is that important? Because if you know how it formed, it gives you a lot of input into how you look for more. Okay, like how do you chase this thing? And what they found is that this system is related to intrusive activity. It's if you look at the Golden Triangle, there's a long history of mineralization in that region. That spans a period of well over 100 million years. I mean, it's a profound piece of earth crust that has had many repeated events that have generated ore deposits, okay? And a lot of the deposits are of older age. We'll call it maybe 180 million years in that range, or even a bit more, okay? And you know, the question when this Sherbet zone was discovered is this one of these older systems, or is it something different? Okay. One of the striking features of it is that absolute predictable planar shape to it. It's a very flat stone. And you know, you think, okay, if there was a lot of tectonic history, you know, that should be folded and buckled and changed. Well, we're finding no, it's not. And so then what is it related to? Well, it turns out to be one of in the more younger age spectrum of the Golden Triangle, and it's probably related to intrusions that have come up during a period, perhaps during what we call the Cretaceous. So say somewhere between 55 and 60, you know, or 70 or 80 million years ago. So it's more of the younger generation, which means we can kind of put our finger now, we can look around us and say, ah, this thing is probably related to that intrusion over there, i.e. it's going to be connected at some level. Now, it could even be connected, of course, to a mineralized porphyry. And that's certainly a possibility here. So it raises a number of intriguing possibilities.
Yeah. So it has potential size maybe beyond what you can see so far.
Correct. Exactly. Yeah, it could be much bigger. Yep.
Quentin, we're in terms of location and infrastructure, that sort of thing is always important in projects. It's in BC. Can you talk to that a little bit?
Yeah, so it's in the southern part of the Golden Triangle. Now, what does this mean? Well, if you look at the town of Kitsault, which is again on one of these fjords, these you know inlets that comes into the interior, to British Columbia, it gives road access and other things. You know, is much easier. So, you know, you got Alice Arm, you got Kitsault in that area. Alice Arm is a little tiny village that you can access directly up to Dolly Varden, for example. And then, you know, if you had to build a road over to Sherbet, it would probably be on the order of a few kilometers, maybe four kilometers, which is absolutely nothing in terms of building roads in British Columbia. Okay, so this is a very important advantage this project has. It is not, you know, hugely remote and, you know, distal, and it's not going to take a huge amount of capital. You got potential road access there. You also have power in the region too, because you know, hydroelectric is big in that area. Okay, so there's a lot of very good things working for this project. You know, also if you ended up building a mill and you make concentrates, well, guess what? You're right at tidewater.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's a lot of really big pluses to this project. The other advantage I'll point out, which isn't, you know, necessarily related to geography so much, but is the deposit itself. Mm-hmm. Being above the valley, you can put your drive in and you work upward. Okay, that's that's amazing. Most times you have to sink a shaft, or, you know, like you have to dig down to get to the darn thing. In this case, you work up, which is really easy because you got gravity working with
gravity. It. Yeah. Yeah, I was going to ask you about that because I remember seeing the topography of this thing. And as you explained, it sort of runs up the mountain and over on the other side, I guess. So it's any native issues there? That's always something that you wonder about.
Look, the native corporations in this area, the native First Nations in this region are pro-mining, which is good. And they're, you know, from what you see around news with some of the other companies in the area, even though Sherbet is an earlier stage discovery, you can see that there's a good advancement of like Dolly Varden, for example, and and other projects. So I'm very confident that this project could be advanced. I do think that there will be also ample opportunity to work with First Nation, you know, perhaps, you know, putting in that mill and so forth. So these are great opportunities in my view. And I think you have First Nations who are very savvy and mining friendly and will understand, you know, where their place is.
Good. Just one more question yet. It's always companies need to raise money to put holes in the ground. I looked at the, I think it was September 30th, the company had working capital about 5.3 million. And I believe they've exercised warrants worth another 1.4 million. How far might that take them in 2023 in terms of their exploration plans? And has the company laid out its exploration plans yet? Does it know exactly where it's going to drill? Has it figured that out, how much it's going to spend and so forth?
It's laid out like in concept some of the exploration, like they've got all their drill pads and locations for drill pads designed. You know, they know where they can put them, I guess is the best way to put it. And they're working right now with some of their advisors, particularly SRK, in where they put infill holes to help them better to establish a resource, things like that. I would say that, you know, they're not quite there, like haven't designed every meter of drilling yet, but they will by the time they start drilling in June. The money that they have in the bank right now should help them get started. You know, it is a very tight time right now. Like liquidity in the mining space is absolutely shocking. This is, you know, the topic of the day is that where and how are all these companies that we love going to do their work? You know, how do they get the money to do their work? The companies that are cashed up, like Goliath, have a much better shot. Okay, they don't need to go running back to the market. They can get started if they, you know, they deem that it's needs to be a bit tighter this year, that they can't drill 24,000 meters. Maybe they got to drill 12,000 meters. Okay, mm-hmm. We got to kind of wish the market it turns around here and we start to see capital come back in. But Goliath is in a good position to go ahead and start their program.
Yeah, a little wind at our backs would be welcome, wouldn't it, Quentin? I think
it sure would.
Very overdue, it would seem. So that's another topic. Maybe we'll talk to Jim Rogers, who's going to be up with us next. So I want to thank you, Quentin, so much for being with us again, sharing your insights into this story, and look to talk to you again sometime in the near future, hopefully. All right, thanks, Quentin. Okay, don't go away, folks, because Jim Rogers is going to be back. He's going to talk about the way he sees the world 20 years after he traveled. He and his fiance traveled the world, 116 countries, actually. They drove around the whole world, 116 countries, and not just the big shots. They went to visit the people in the villages, the village chiefs, some fairly dangerous, almost didn't escape with their lives a couple of times. But anyway, Jimmy has the idea. Yes, he'll tell you how he sees the world now, 20 years later. So don't go away. We'll be right back with Jim Rogers. Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really excited today to have Jim Rogers with me. Thank you for joining me today, Jim.
I'm delighted, Jay. It's been a long time, and it was always a lot of fun, so I'm very, very pleased to be
here. It's always an honor to be in your presence, and I know we've met a couple of times personally in Chicago and New York and so forth. But what I'd like to do, Jim, is to get your view of the world 20 years later. And I say 20 years later because it was 2003 when you published this book, Venture Capitalists. And it really was published in 2003, but actually it covers your world travels, you and your fiance Paige, at the turn of the century. And I don't know how many countries, 116 or something you saw. You visited, and you didn't visit with the people at the top, you know, the rich and the powerful, so much as you visited with the common folks. And that's the way you learn to know what the countries are really about. I think you read somewhere that you can learn more from the madam and the brothel and the other sleazy characters that you might find in life than you can by talking with the makers and the shakers. So a venture capitalist, go ahead, Jim.
I was just going to interrupt for one second to hold that thought. You know, I've never been to a prostitute, but I have bumped into a couple of madams, and I will tell you, they know everything. They know everything in town, if not just the town, in the country.
Yeah.
If you want to know about a country, find the brothel and ask. Don't find the prostitutes, find the madams.
Yeah, very good. I wasn't expecting that you were a patron of those places, Jim, but to figure out what's going on in the world, probably so. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. So Adventure Capitalist was written, as I say, in 2003. But I really believe that people should still read this book. I want to get your view of the world now, 20 years later. But I still think it's worth a read because for most of us, we can't travel the world the way you did, but you can certainly learn a lot about what the world was like back then. Maybe I'd like to start out by just asking you to review a little bit when you left New York City and why you chose to go to Singapore.
Well, I just wanted to quickly say about the trip and the book. I've been around the world once before on a motorcycle, as you know, but nobody had ever been around the world at the turn of a millennium. So I said, aha, this is a unique opportunity. And if anybody's ever been around the world at the turn of the millennium, they didn't put it on the internet. They didn't write a book about it. So I set off to do that so that there would be a record of what the world was like at the turn of the millennium. That's partly what this book was all about. Mm-hmm. And you can look at it 80 years from now and say, oh my gosh, you know what they were doing in the year 2000, etc. So that's the whole purpose of the book. The trip was to have fun and to learn, and to have adventure, but the book was the turn of the millennium. We then moved to Singapore. I mean, I don't know if you remember, Jay, but I've been telling people for a long time that they should teach their children and grandchildren Chinese, Mandarin. Then I had one. Oh my gosh, what do I do now? So to make a long story short, I realized that if I really was serious, you're gonna have to take my daughter, one daughter at the time, to live in a place where she had no choice but to speak Chinese. The Chinese cities were too polluted. So we wound up in Singapore. Everything works in Singapore. They speak English and they speak Mandarin. So here we are. And it's been a very good experience for all of us.
Wow. Well, so yeah, and they're speaking very well from what I understand. And you're very proud of your daughters. It's
I'm going to brag for one more minute. The Chinese tell me that my daughters speak better Chinese than they do. They put them on TV because their Chinese is so good. I mean, I speak no Chinese, so I have nothing to do with this. But that part has been successful.
Well, it was
at least if they ever have to work in a Chinese restaurant, they'll be the maitre d'. They won't be the dishwasher.
Well, that's probably right. Well, you've got to be very proud of them, Jim. And I know that, you know, you've had a very successful life. You've had a very successful life. I think it was at age 37 or so that you had, you know, had made a fortune and you could have retired at that point in time. And I guess more or less you did about that time. But then since then, you've been a professor at Columbia, I believe. I used to see you all the time on television, on CNBC and elsewhere. And you've traveled the world and you've written prolifically. I mean, this is just one of several books you've written. So you've had a full life. And so, I mean, it's really to get your view of the world now, I think is very valuable because of because of what you knew going back 20 years ago. And I'm sure you still stay in touch with what's going on in the world as much as ever. So I'd like to maybe start out just by asking you a question that Adam Taggart, my good friend, likes to ask when he interviews you. And I know you've been interviewed by Adam in the past as well. What is your current assessment of the global economy and the financial markets?
Well, you should watch you, Jay. You know better than I do.
Oh, I doubt that. No, I doubt that very much.
Well, as you know, it's been over 10, it's been, 12, 13 years since we had a recession in the right. U.S. That's the longest in American history. Doesn't mean it won't last 40 years, but at least historically, we're getting close to the end in time for a recession. Signs are starting to develop. Inflation is back. Interest rates are going higher, et cetera. I've seen this rodeo before. You know, it's not my first rodeo. So the signs are there that it's coming. And I certainly expect like you do, but for 2023, just about everybody in the world is anticipating the recession of 2023.
Yeah.
Which, in my experience, when everybody knows something is about to happen, certainly in the financial markets, it rarely happens.
Right.
It's either already happened or people have moved on to something else. So, yes, I see the signs. I know we're going to have a serious recession. I know the next one that we have is going to be the worst in my lifetime. You remember 2008? Well, 2008 was because of too much debt. Oh, Jay, since 2009, the debt has skyrocketed everywhere.
Right.
So the next recession has to be very, very serious. Now, Washington says we won't have another recession. If you believe them, you know, they have very fancy education. If you believe them, Yeah. Don't listen to me, but I'm telling you, we're going to have another recession someday. Maybe later this year, maybe next year, but when we have it, it's going to be extremely serious because the debt is so high everywhere, not just the U.S., everywhere.
Yeah, it's a world phenomenon, I'm afraid. So much debt everywhere, Jim. We went on this fiat currency system completely in 1971, and led by the United States, we've just gone nuts, spending money that we don't have, living beyond our means. However, there's one, you know, some countries behaved in some ways much more responsibly than the United States. And one I believe that acted more responsibly is China, for example. They certainly sold the world more things than they bought from the rest of the world, building up foreign currency reserves that they've been able to use to build, not to make weapons and to destroy countries, but to build the one brick, one road, the infrastructure that is just, I think, just amazing. But maybe I shouldn't talk so much about my views on China since you're my guest. You turned very bullish on China, certainly in your book in 2003. What did you see about China then that caused you to turn so bullish on that country?
The first time I went to China was 1984, and I was terrified because American propaganda all my life had said the Chinese are evil, vicious, bloodthirsty, dangerous people.
Yeah.
I got there and I thought, wait a minute, this is not like most propaganda.
Yeah.
This is not correct. They were hardworking, very thrifty, very ambitious. They educated and disciplined their children. So I could see what was happening. China's been the only country in world history that's been on top three or four times. They've collapsed three or four times in the last few thousand years. But I could see that they were rising again. I continue to see that. They are going to be, the changes that have taken place in the past 40 years in China are unbelievable, staggering, and they're continuing. China will certainly have problems along the way. The United States, became the most successful country in the 20th century. But Jay, remember the problems we had? Civil war, depression, massacres in the streets. Mm-hmm. You know, you could buy and sell Congress. You can still buy and sell congressmen in America, but they were cheap 100 years ago. You know, we had terrible problems, but we did it. China's going to have problems. I don't know what or when, but whether we like it or not, a lot of people obviously don't like it, but somebody has to be the big country again, and it's going to be China next time.
It sure looks
like that. That doesn't have to be negative for anybody. That could be very positive. We could all have great prosperity together. Unfortunately, some of the people in Washington want to pick a fight, but for 40 years, the Chinese grew and prospered, and we prospered with them. I hope we can continue that.
Right. Some people, it was Eisenhower that was worried about the military-industrial complex, and it certainly does seem they wield a lot of power in terms of policy and propaganda, but that's another topic, maybe for another time. Huh? So in that same book, your view of Russia wasn't so positive. What was it about Russia that you didn't see as a good place to put your money back at the turn of the century?
Well, you see what's happened. I guess I was right about that, Mr. Yeah. Putin and the guys. There were some good positive things that have happened in Russia. The Soviet Union is gone. You know, they have a lot of assets. But, you know, Mr. Putin, for whatever reason, has gone to war. Now, he was certainly provoked to a large extent by NATO. I'm not defending Mr. Putin at all. You know, there's no reason for anybody to be at war now. But, you know, like most wars, there are two sides to everything. And the way Russia has turned out, it's certainly not a place. Well, first of all, I cannot put money into Russia right now, but it's certainly not a good place to put money, and has not been, because now we got this huge, this absurd war.
Well, certainly Russia is aligned with China more closely, and I think in part the United States policies, the United States policies against Russia and when they went into Ukraine was certainly part of it. It almost seemed as though Russia had no choice but to turn to China, to countries it could trade with, because the United States basically has frozen it out. Do you think the U.S. may have pushed Russia closer to China right now?
Of course they have. I mean, you know, this is, the Russians are doing a good, a wise thing for them. The Chinese are doing a wise thing for them. We have pushed them both closer and closer together. We have not done, been very smart in all of this, if you ask me. Unfortunately, you know, we're making the dollar less reliable for many people in the world. You know, the world's reserve currency has been the U.S. dollar, but now people say, wait a minute, the reserve currency is supposed to be neutral. Anybody can use it for anything. Mm-hmm. But now the U.S. has changed those rules, and if they get angry at you, they cut you off. So many of our friends, Jay, are starting to say, well, wait a minute, we got to find something else in case, because they might cut us off too. So yeah. Unfortunately, it's accelerating the move to find a competing currency to the U.S. dollar. I don't know what it's going to be yet. If you know, please don't announce it on the show. Send me an email, because I'm trying to find it.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because, you know, so many things are changing. Like in the Shanghai, you can let me know if I'm wrong about this, but I believe that in Shanghai, they've put together a futures market for oil. And I think they've got a futures market for gold. But at the same time, we're seeing Saudi Arabia become warm, closer to China, a warming of that relationship, it seems. So the Saudis, in theory, could sell their oil to China for yuan, take the yuan and buy gold and get paid in gold rather than dollars. And if you look at the price of gold, the price of oil, if you look at oil priced in gold over the last number of decades, it hasn't moved in terms of ounces of gold to purchase a barrel of oil. So it seems to me it might make sense for the Saudis to do that. Any thoughts?
It's happening. The Saudis have, you know, had to be extremely reliable on us for several decades, but now the Saudis are looking around like everybody else, and they're getting closer to the Chinese. They're selling oil to the Chinese. Uh-huh. They're taking Chinese currency for the oil. No, I mean, you know, I don't like saying any of this, Jay, because I'm an American too, but we're pushing the world away from us.
Yes.
And pushing our enemies together. Yeah. And here's a perfect example. The Saudis couldn't spell the name of another country for many decades. Mm-hmm. Now they're doing their best to find other friends.
So if we head into a recession, Jim, do you think, you know, a lot of people are counting on inflation being tame, interest rates going back down towards zero? It seems like a disconnect to me when we're running, we have a 30 plus trillion dollar debt. Once upon a time, the Chinese bought our debt, the Japanese bought our debt, the Saudis bought our debt. They're not doing it now. We're left pretty much at these interest rates. You know what? The Fed has to buy our debt. I mean, I don't know what price it would take right now to clear the markets, what interest rate it would take to clear the markets right now. Do you see the possibility of going back to anything like normal? Like, that's the propaganda we get here. Everything's going to be sunny again one day.
Well, I know you have learned, and I've certainly learned, not to take my investment advice from Washington. If you rely on Washington for your advice, you're going to go broke. So you're not old enough to remember, but in the 70s, we had a big inflation boom.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And interest rates, short-term treasury bills, 90-day treasury bills were yielding over 21%. That's not a typo. 21% on treasury bills, because they had to drive interest rates so high to kill inflation. They did it. It worked. And the inflation situation is much worse now. Much, much worse for many reasons. So this is not over yet. Before this is over, inflation, I mean, interest rates are going to be very, very high. And I hope we all survive.
Yeah, well, inflation rising, interest rates rising, obviously it changes the mix of investment opportunities, at least the investment sectors that you can make money in. I think it was not that long ago, maybe within the last year or so, you felt that commodities were one of the few things that were still cheap. Do you still feel that way?
Well, as I look around, I know bonds aren't cheap. Bonds have never been this expensive, even after, you know, correcting recently. Stocks are forming bubbles in some countries, including in the U.S. Property, if you go to New Zealand or Korea or some places, I mean, property is a serious bubble. So the only cheap asset left is that I know of are commodities. I mean, silver. Silver's down, you know, 60% from its all-time high.
Yep.
You know, sugar's down 60% or so. I mean, those are not bubble numbers. I'm not suggesting you rush out and buy commodities right now. But when you have inflation, if you own the things that go up in price, you make money. Mm-hmm. Inflation, by definition, is rising prices, and the things that go up at least are commodities, and they will again.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly, I still track your commodity index, the one that you put together years ago. It's still, see it, I go to Bloomberg and catch it every weekend when I do some other statistics here in my office, and grateful to you for that. That index, I believe you reset that. How often is that? That's reset? Is it re?
Well, we would, every day, if something happens, I mean, if suddenly we find out orange juice causes cancer, we're going to take the orange juice out of the index.
I see.
Unless something dramatic happens, a good index, Jay, never changes.
Yeah.
That's the definition. That's the index you want. So it doesn't change often, but if we see something happen dramatic, then we have to change it, and we will, and we do.
Well, Jim, you know, they're already starting to talk about a presidential election here. I mean, it's sort of sickening, and it drives you crazy to have to watch this stuff. I guess you don't have to. You can go to the internet these days. People aren't spending nearly as much time on cable TV as they once did. You know, what are your thoughts? I mean, does it make a difference? Does it make a difference who our president is? I mean, if anybody gets in the way of the people that really have the power, maybe he doesn't last too long, or she doesn't last too long.
We are going to have an election in 2024. You can write it down. 2024, we will. I didn't say we would in 28 and after that, but we certainly are going to have one in 2024, unless they really blow up the world, which these guys could. Will it matter? Of course, because whoever's president, he and his friends make more money, and the other guys don't make as much money. So it makes a difference to the people who are there, because all of their friends make more money. And some of the things they do might make a difference. But I mean, you're very observant, you're perceptive, you know as well as I do. Most of these guys do not do anything new and dramatic because they're afraid. They don't have creative ideas, and even if they did, they couldn't get away with it. So, no, it's a sad commentary. Do I like it? No. I've got teenage children, you know, but I see what's happening just the same way you do.
Yeah. Well, what sort of advice would you have for, let's say, upper middle class people that might still have some wealth in America? I mean, the middle class is rapidly disappearing in America, unfortunately, it seems to me, to a great extent. Inflation is wiping out wages and so forth. Where could people, I mean, where geographically, I mean, country-wise, where is there any place that's safe to invest these days? I mean, you can own commodities, I guess, if you have them in your possession. Gold and silver you can have in your possession as long as someone doesn't steal them or the government doesn't take it from you. That's wealth. What advice would you have for people that still have some money, you know, upper middle class, wealthier people? Where should they be allocating? Are some of the foreign markets much better than the U.S. now?
Well, you used the word safe before. There's no such thing as safe in the investment world. It never has been.
Never has
been. There are not many countries right now, maybe Japan, because the Bank of Japan is printing a lot of money and buying ETFs. China's down. If one wants to invest in depressed markets, Uzbekistan is an old Soviet republic that was ruined by the Soviets. The new people there are doing the right things. Now, Uzbekistan is not a big market, and it's a new market, but I have started putting money in Uzbekistan because they have gigantic resources, and they're running the country the way you and I would run the country now. I hope that will continue. But it's hard to find these days, Jay.
Yeah.
We had a long bull market, the longest in American history, so it's hard for me to find things. Yes, I mentioned, you know, commodities, but you know, I don't know, and nothing is compelling in commodities for me today in 2023. I'm watching, I'm looking, so there, I don't really have a lot of compelling things to buy or even short right now.
Yeah, I'm
not selling short because I don't know anything that's compelling. You know, all the stocks that boomed so much, the Amazons, the Tencents, they all came down some, so. And I'm expecting there will be a last rally in the markets.
Mm-hmm.
I hope, if it happens, I hope I'm smart enough to sell it and sell it short.
Right. Yeah, I mean, shorting is difficult. It's no doubt about it, because especially with all the government intervention and central bank intervention these days, it's hard to know where things are going to go. Just, I guess, before we close, Jim, I'd like to ask you if there is there a way that people can kind of track what your thoughts are, what you're doing? Are you writing anything these days? And maybe another book. It's 10 years ago you wrote another book.
Well,
writing a book is hard.
I've had a couple of actually bestsellers in Japan.
Uh-huh.
As writing about Japan, Korea. But no, to answer your question, do I have any more books? No, not right now. Who knows what will happen in the future?
Yeah.
And as far as I don't have a website yet. I don't have anything to sell.
Okay.
I'm
well,
sorry. I'm boring.
You're not. Anything but boring, Jim. I'm so thankful that you spend your time with us today, and just wanted to really. I mean, I really admire you, not just because of your success in life, but also because I think of you, a man of integrity that has made some hard decisions through your life that, you know, a lot of people might not have made. But to me, that's golden. That's very important. And I think I read your grandfather also, you have a tradition of integrity in your family. Your grandfather made some difficult choices too, because he believed something was right and it was wrong to go against those values. So to me, that's as important as your millions of dollars that you made in the past, Jim. But we do thank you so much for spending time with us. And well, I hope we can do it again sometime in the not too distant future.
Well, I hope so too, Jay. But to your previous statement, I look back and I realize that my parents and grandparents, you know, they had this very, very strong sense of integrity and honesty and all of that. Whether that's good to pass on to your children or not, but they passed it on to me. And in the end, most people who are honest and can be trusted are likely to be more successful than people who cannot be trusted. You know that as well as I do.
Right. No doubt about that, Jim. And of course, you're passing that on to all the people that are viewing this message as well. So thank you so much. Well, folks, if you like this video, hit the like button at the bottom of your screen and subscribe to this channel. That is it for this week until next Wednesday, when I'm hoping to have Alistair MacLeod with me to talk about gold's return as money. Alistair recently wrote an article. We'll ask him about that. So until next Wednesday, goodbye and God's blessings to you.